If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Hello, everyone. This is a slightly different way of doing my regular interview format, basically because I have a guest and a topic, a wild idea that I want to get to really quickly. So I want to get this episode out as fast as possible and not get it bogged down in the production process. So we'll keep it nice and raw and quite brief. So I have with me today Isabel Reinicke, and I've known of Isabel for a while, mostly through social media and through the news. She founded the Grata Fund, a not-for-profit that works at a legal level on a bunch of landmark cases in Australia, affecting offshore detention centres and First Nations issues. She's a lawyer, a systems change, and has won a number of leadership awards. And she's a new mum as well. So we're very, very lucky to have her here. Welcome to Wild, Isabel. It's so wonderful to see you actually, I suppose, as close to in real life on a Zoom screen.
I know. It's lovely to chat with you.
Now, look, tell us briefly what the Grata Fund is, how it was set up, why you set it up, and some examples of cases that people might have heard of so they just get a little bit of context here.
Sure. I describe myself as a lawyer amongst campaigners and a campaigner amongst lawyers, and that sort of sums up Grata Fund pretty well. We sort of work often behind the scenes to try and orchestrate really big structural systemic change litigation. The idea being that, you know, actually courts exist for us to use to hold big, powerful entities like the government or corporations accountable. And what we try and do is really make that easier. But also what we do is make sure that campaigns are surrounding big litigation. You know, the kind of concept is let's challenge power in court, but let's also really build power in communities. And that's really what we seek to do.
What are some you cases? Mentioned
we, we worked on a really wide range of cases, and we, you know, traverse lots of different subjects in the media at the moment. As we're speaking, there's been a big case called Giggle and Tickle, which is a case about transgender women's rights. We've been supporting Roxy in that case to really say, actually, you know, I'm a trans woman and I'm a woman, and I deserve not to be discriminated against on that basis. So that's one example. We've supported a range of litigation in the Northern Territory, working with remote communities to secure humane housing rights and actually the right to not drink uranium in your tap water. So supporting communities to sue the Northern Territory government for actually not providing safe drinking water. And, you know, that's the sort of thing we do, but across a broad range of issues.
Yeah, they're the cases that often get the headlines. We often don't realise that there are a bunch of people in the background, a not-for-profit, pushing it onto the front pages, because they probably wouldn't make it to the front pages without a fund like Grata Fund. So, yeah, bravo to your work there, for your work there.
Thank you.
But let's get on to the case that I feel a lot of people listening here would like to know about, and also need to know about. And it extends beyond Australia's borders. It really has global significance, and it has a significance which is hard to fathom. It really is a once in a lifetime moment, which is exactly why I want to have you here, because it's that big. It's loosely called the Uncles case or the Australian climate case. Can you give us an overview of what this case is about? And then we'll go into some details.
Yeah, so it's really kind of the grand poobah of litigation. I sort of say I can retire once we're done with it, because it's been so big. And that's because what it's trying to do is get to the point that the Australian government is forced to reduce emissions massively this decade. It's basically about holding the Australian government for its inaction on climate change in a way that actually makes big change for how we operate.
Mm. And where do the uncles come into this? They're the two Torres Strait Islander men who have brought this case. It sounds quite a niche moment in history, but it's from this that, you know, the whole case has been able to pivot outwards. Can you explain where they fit into the picture?
Yeah, absolutely. So Uncle Paul and Uncle Pabai are two Gadamalgal traditional owners. So they're from the most northern part of the Torres Strait, or the most northern part of Australia. You literally can look out Uncle Paul's back veranda and you can see Papua New Guinea just sort of across the water and dinghy right away. But, you know, spiritually and, you know, geographically very much part of Australia. And the uncles and their communities are facing kind of the most extreme examples of climate impacts today. We're not just talking about, you know, devastating floods, for example. We're talking about floods plus homes that are going to be completely uninhabitable within our lifetime. So their islands are essentially sinking, and the water is rising around their islands at double the rate of the water rising in the rest of the world. So, you know, for example, Uncle Pabai's island Boigu is a metre and a half above sea level, and the projections are that his island will be two-thirds underwater in the next 10 years or so. That means, you know, it's not going to be long till people actually can't live on those islands anymore. And, you know, Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul talk about it as a cultural genocide waiting to happen. It's sort of the final death blow of colonisation. You know, they've survived 250 years of colonization and thousands of years before that as communities on those islands. But despite having basically not caused climate change at all, they're the first to suffer the worst consequences. And they talk about becoming Australia's first climate change refugees if more isn't done. And so they are bringing the case against the Australian government and basically saying to the court, please force the government to do two things. Make them stop causing the harm, make them stop causing climate change through their approach to climate change, and also make them help us so that we're better equipped to deal with what's coming. Mm. And they're really proud about the fact that they're doing this both for their communities and their children and their grandchildren, but they're actually doing it with effect for all of Australians' people and the whole world.
The world. Absolutely. The scope is that big. Now, let's just backtrack a little bit, because this whole idea, this case, came about off the back of a Dutch movement, a Dutch case that I've been aware of for a number of years, but it was actually boiling along for a while. It went in and out of the courts. It was appealed, then it won, then it was appealed, and then it won. And I think it was a couple of years ago it finally arrived in the headlines and we all became aware of it. Can you explain that case and how it's now connected to what you're now doing with this uncle's case?
Absolutely. So that was a really big deal, because that Dutch case was the first time that a court had said to a national government, actually, what you're doing is so harmful that it's illegal and you have to change course. And they ordered the Dutch government reduce emissions significantly. And that was a binding order. And it had a massive impact on the Dutch climate infrastructure and, you know, investment in renewables and closure of fossil fuels, for example. And that's because when you get a court order like this, as a government, you can't get out of it. There's nothing you can really do to kind of undermine it. You actually just have to do what the court says. Sort of the beauty of democracy is that courts can actually force our parliaments to do things that they don't want to do if that's what the law says they should do. And the concept is the same in this case. So that Dutch case sprouted a kind of global movement of countries around the world saying, we need to do the same thing as what the Dutch have done. That includes cases in South Korea that are on foot at the moment, in France, in Ireland, in Germany, most recently a case in Belgium, one in December at the end of last year, the same concept. And so we've basically been working with that team, that international team, for years to try and make something similar happen in Australia, and we're really at the kind of final hurdle of it now.
And that Dutch team, I think, came to you targeting Australia because Australia has one of the worst records for climate commitments, and went, well, let's focus on Australia. If we can get something off the ground in Australia, then we're really going to get some traction. And of course, these other ones have happened around the world since. So this, as you say, is a really big deal. It's a big deal in the international community who are working on these kinds of cases. So, all right, that gives a bit of the background. Now, can you talk through the implications? So I think my understanding is it's going to be in front of the federal court, and it's going to be a case that's going to be heard in Cairns later this month, so in April. And what happens if you win? Talk us through that.
If we win, it really changes everything. What it means is the government will be forced to rapidly cut emissions this decade. That means things like no more gas and no more coal approvals.
It like
means
literally things, none? Like they will be held to none. Account on that? Okay.
Yeah, you can't stay within our budget of emissions and approve new coal and gas in Australia. We just have run out enough.
Which we all know, and we're sitting back watching the government continue to approve these projects and wondering how it all adds up. And this case would then say, well, it doesn't, and you're going to have to do your sums correctly.
That's exactly right. I mean, there are two different types of climate cases, and we see a lot of one type, and that's where you target a particular development. Because it has in some way breached a law, whether that's an environmental law or a law of First Nations protection. This kind of case is a bit different. It's a negligence law. So you need to think about a different kind of case altogether. It's the kind of case that you bring if you have been working on a site that's had asbestos exposure and it's made you really, really sick. It's that kind of case where the people who were responsible for making you sick, or in this case, responsible for causing climate change, are held accountable in a way that really, really sticks long term for a whole approach of government rather than just a project by project approach. What the court can't do is tell the government how to get there. That's the role of the government, not the role of the court. But what the court can say is that there is a level of harm that the government is causing and knowingly causing that's having effects today, and it's going to get way worse really fast if you don't change course. And the court can say it's just untenable for the government to be allowed to cause such harm to the population in a knowing way and get away with it.
So if the government was to approve a coal or gas mine after this case is won, what would happen then? What recourse does the court have from there?
It gives people the power to bring a case called an injunction. That's basically the word means stop in law. So it brings the ability for someone to say, actually, you have to stop this approval because by doing it, you will be doing something that's contrary to what the court said you have to stop doing over here. So it's one of those things that, you know, it has a broad framework impact that affects everything from kind of the top down, but also the bottom up. It really changes everything. And I think, you know, you talk to the uncles and their communities in the Torres Strait, and they've got a really proud history of making that sort of progress through the courts, through the legacy of Eddie Mabo and the Mabo decision, which, you know, was really the basis for us to be able to have proper recognition of First Nations land rights in Australia. So the Torres Strait has a long history of doing this sort of nation-shaping cases, and they're pretty excited about it this time.
Do you think this case will be as significant and history-changing as the Mabo case?
That's the category of case we're talking about. It's a true nation-shaping case that has ramifications for generations to come. That's why I kind of joke that I can retire if we win the case. Not that I will. But, that's the order of magnitude we're talking about.
What are the chances? What do you think the chances are that you'll win? I know you can't really
I want to win.
Bet on this, yeah, but what's the sense in the legal community?
Look, the tide's definitely turning, and it's turning in the right direction. So just a couple of nights ago, Australian time, the European Human Rights Court found in favour of Swiss senior women who brought a case basically saying a very similar thing to this case, saying, you know, we are impacted by climate change right now. In that case, it was about heat impacts of climate change in Switzerland, and it's going to get much worse. And the court agreed that actually the government of Switzerland has a legal obligation to reduce emissions to stop causing that harm. That's just one case, but it's part of a broader wave of cases that you see internationally, as well as case changes in Australia as well, where the courts are catching up with the fact that actually the facts of climate change are so profound and so terrible that it becomes a matter for law to get involved, for the courts to say, look, actually, there's a level of harm the government's actually lawfully cannot knowingly cause to their own populations.
You mentioned that there are sort of two aspects to the case that the uncles are bringing forward. There's the stopping the emissions, stopping the harm, and then there's also the mitigation, help with the adaptation stuff. What could the case bring about if you win in for that piece, for the mitigation piece?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would be the first step in building a body of law that says actually governments are forced to deal with the adaptation required for climate change. So in the Torres Strait, that's funding for things like mangrove regeneration so that people's homes aren't flooded. That's things like emergency evacuation services. You know, you speak to people in communities in the Torres Strait, one senior elder, Auntie McRose Elu, is a exceptional elder who is also Senior Queenslander of the Year. And, you know, she says, you know, who's going to come for us when the next king tide hits and we get swept off onto the ocean? Is it our poor cousins over in Papua New Guinea to come in their dinghies? You know, who's literally going to come save us? There's just no preparedness for what's coming. And I think that's really profound because it echoes the experience of people near me where I live in Lismore who, you know, people weren't saved either there during those floods 2 years ago. You know, people, you know, were helping each other. They were, you know, trying to find ways of getting people, cutting people out of roofs. And, you know, we're no better prepared than we were 2 years ago for those sorts of crises. You know, you'll recall this, you know, the fires in the south coast of New South Wales. You know, people couldn't get away from the fires because the ATMs weren't working, so they couldn't buy petrol to be able to drive their cars away from the fires. Yeah. People were stranded on beaches. You know, we have that sort of level of unpreparedness for what is coming. And this case has the power to actually start to build a body of law that says that's not good enough.
Yeah, wow. I think that piece is very significant because I think Australians are on to that. We're on to the fact that we're feeling so stranded and so unsupported. I'm wondering, this is a question that you may or may not be able to answer, but I just wonder, of course, our current Labor government, for anyone listening to this, Australia is a bit of an outlier in the Western world or the world generally, in that we do have a left-leaning, or at least a government that, you know, purported to be left-leaning in power at the moment. And they did come in on something of a climate sort of promise. With the support of a bunch of independents as well, who were also voted in based on climate policies. So I am just wondering, I can't help but think that the government at the moment feels very beholden to the fossil fuel industry, to all the various forces in our mainstream media, the funding, the lobbying, but also a lot of pushback from the opposition, the same position that most governments face around the world. Do you sense, and I'm sure you're speaking to all kinds of parties here, but do you sense that there might be a sense of relief, right, that the courts are actually going to force us to do the thing we kind of want to do and we know we should be doing, but, you know, short-term thinking, the financial situation, all of the handcuffs that a government experiences, it prevents them from doing what they would wish to do and also to leave behind as legacy. Do you think it's going to do them a favour?
I do. I mean, I think we're helping the government here. They might not feel that way, but I mean, I really do think, right now, but, you know, I do feel like we're helping them because, you know, there is a clear need for greater action. There's a really difficult political environment for greater action. And I think that's when litigation is the most powerful. It's where you're, you know, really bringing cases confronting a government that can't act or won't act. And the courts can come in and say, actually, this is out of your hands. This is a matter of law. You have to do this thing. Mm. Whether people are, you know, happy about that or not depends on who you're talking to within a party. I think that sort of makes sense, I guess. But, you know, my hope is that, you know, if and when the case succeeds, that the government will embrace it and, you know, find a way to work with it so that we can all see, you know, really the safe future that we all want to live in.
I see that it could be something of a gift. And we've been talking about this on Wild and on my Substack as well, about this notion of Moloch, about a sort of a race to the bottom, a zero-sum race to the bottom that we all feel that we're trapped in, where governments feel that they literally can't make the better move because if they do, they'll be at a disadvantage and so on and so forth. And an intervention like this almost stalls or reverses that race to the bottom for us. It's sort of like an adult walking into the room and going, right, enough, kids, you over there, this is the new lay of the land. I guess the question begs, we've got this case going on. It starts at the end of April. It'll run for a number of weeks. I imagine it'll take some time for the federal court to decide its verdict. What can we do? I imagine there's a lot of people listening who are thinking, my goodness, this is exactly what we need. Let's not let this opportunity pass. Are you just literally needing eyeballs on this? Are you needing people to share it, to pick up on news items when the case starts to make headlines, and just sharing it so that the government and all of the various policymakers, the stakeholders in all of this go, hey, this actually is something that the nation wants. Is that kind of where you're at?
That's so important. I mean, what we really need is to build a lot of awareness and momentum around it so that when we do have a decision, hopefully later in the year, but, you know, hard to know when a judgment's going to come out, but hopefully at the end of the year, you actually have people aware of what it means. And so that means if it wins, we can really support the government to say, actually, this is what people want. We do want this. Let us help you to do this in a way that, you know, is not going to hurt you politically. Or on the kind of counter idea, if it doesn't succeed, we can actually make an argument to the government saying, you know, this might be legal for you to be doing today. It might not be down the track, but it might be legal now, but it's just not moral. And use that pressure and that argument to really force further action from the government. The first thing is really just bringing awareness to the case, helping people understand that, you know, Torres Strait Islander people are bringing this case for themselves, but they're also bringing it for all of us, and it actually has massive ramifications for all of us. There are a couple of other things that people can do if they want to do even more than that. We've got a solidarity pledge that people can sign that really says that they're standing with the uncles. That kind of thing is actually so important and enforcing and validating the communities we're working with. You know, you wouldn't believe how much it means to people who feel extremely isolated and ignored to know that people around the country are actually really supporting them.
Yeah.
The world as well. Amnesty International has been supporting with letters from around the world, their membership, and those sorts of things that, you know, framed in people's homes in the Torres Strait because, you know, they're so excited to know that they're not isolated in the way that they sometimes feel. And then the next thing that people can do is just share their story of climate impact. So many people in Australia and around the world are already experiencing climate change. It's not just in the Torres Strait. You might have experienced a flood. You might have experienced a fire. You might just be experiencing really hot days. And so your kids, when they're at childcare, have to spend the day inside in the aircon and are stir crazy because they can't play outside in the yard as much as carers know they could have done back in the day. So there are lots of stories that people have that they can share, and we have a way for people to share those, and we're collecting them from across the country to build solidarity with the uncles and their communities, but to also show to Parliament, you know, people are having impacts right now. It's not a future question. You need to act now.
Will you present that to Parliament, will you, at some stage? Is that part of the campaign?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure there'd be people interested because I'm just hearing more and more Australians, but, you know, people around the world talking about the fact that they can't even insure their homes any longer.
Exactly.
This stuff is real. Like, we're in it. We're in everything that we were warned about. And, I think many people have been feeling powerless. This is actually something that we can all latch onto. It is a gift. You know, the uncles are presenting a gift. You know, once again, First Nations people are offering a gift to us, an opportunity. And I do see it as an opportunity we can jump on, and we need to do it now. So anyone listening, I really invite you to share this episode, but also just share any news items. I'll be doing the same. Share them, tag people. If you're an influencer, I invite you to do the same. It's a fairly easy task. It's a non-controversial thing to be engaged in, to be, you know, on the right side of history. I hate that phrase, but this is something that I think we can all get behind. Hey, Isabel, is there anything else that you want to say before we sign off so that we can keep this nice and short and people can get on with going and signing pledges and spreading the word? Is there anything that we should know?
No, just to say thank you. And, you know, I guess, you know, I understand that it can feel really insurmountable, climate action and climate inaction, but this is something really tangible that people can support. And, you know, it's will make you feel, I think, empowered. I hope it'll make you feel empowered, but it'll go a long way to supporting others as well. So yeah. I think it's a great thing to do.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity, really. And thank you to the uncles as well, if you can pass that on to them as well.
Absolutely.
Good luck. I'll be following it closely in April.
Thank you.
It's called the Uncles Case or the Australian Climate Case. I think it will make headlines internationally. There'll be a lot of eyeballs on this. Let's make sure ours are all on it as well.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.